Okay, so first of all, this lecture is being sponsored by the journal Classical and Quantum Gravity. I'm actually the editor of Classical and Quantum Gravity, but despite my biased view on this, I think I can honestly assert to you that it really is an excellent journal, and those of you who are not already regularly publishing your mathematical relativity or other gravitational papers in Classical and Quantum Gravity should find Judith Adams, I guess, who's sitting there during the breaks, who'll probably be over by the Classical and Quantum Gravity table, and speak to her about, or ask her about, more details about the journal and its properties. Okay, now back to our regular programming, which is quantum field theory and curved space time. So let me begin by telling you what quantum field theory and curved space-time is and what it is that I want to tell you about in this talk. So first of all, it's the theory of quantum fields that are propagating in a classical curved space-time. So it's not quantum gravity. The classical curved space-time will be assumed to be globally hyperbolic. Otherwise, we don't really even have a well-posed classical field theory. I should just mention, to get it out of the way, that one interesting thing one would want to do in the context of quantum field theory and curved space-time is consider back reaction effects of the quantum field on the space-time by some semi-classical version of Einstein's equation. This introduces a whole new set of issues. The dynamics defined at least straightforwardly by this equation won't actually be well posed. It's not clear that back reaction can really be, you know, fully described properly in the semi-classical framework other than in some approximate sense. I will not be discussing this issue. I'm going to just be considering then a fixed globally hyperbolic curved space-time and worry about the nature of quantum field theory in that space-time. I won't be talking about any applications of the theory in this talk. I'll be concerned entirely with the formulation of the theory, and what I'll be mostly focusing on is the formulation, the perturbative formulation at least, of interacting quantum field theory and curved space-time. That's an area where there's been an enormous amount of progress within the last 10 years. I should also say that in this talk, I will restrict consideration to a scalar field, Klein-Gordon field, possibly with curvature coupling. It doesn't really, massless or massive, doesn't make any difference for what I'm going to say. But as I'll remark at the end of the talk, of course, essentially all of what I say should be applicable to essentially all other fields. I'll say a little bit more about that. Okay, well, quantum field theory is a quite mature subject. At least those of you that are physicists will have thick books on in your office shelf on quantum field theory in flat space time. If I were giving a talk about how to generalize classical theory, field theory from flat space time to curved space time, I could finish that in about a minute or less. So what is the difficulty with extending quantum field theory in flat space-time to curved space-time? Well, it is, in fact, I claim, quite non-trivial because of the way quantum field theory in flat space-time has been formulated. If you go to one of these thick quantum field theory books, whether textbook graduate level or axiomatic or whatever book you have, you'll see that Poincaré symmetry plays a very fundamental role in the formulation of the theory. Maybe even more fundamental or crucial in the way quantum field theory is formulated is the notion of a preferred vacuum state, which is Poincaré invariant. Associated with this vacuum state is a notion of particles that also play a big role, at least in discussions of the theory. And in fact, most of what is calculated in quantum field theory in flat space-time, has to do with particle aspects of the theory and calculation of S matrices and so on. If you now then look a little bit more detail at the techniques and methods that are used to do all the calculations, all the renormalization theory and so on, you'll see that people take global Fourier transforms and basically do everything in momentum space, and or they use Euclidean methods, basically changing T to IT in Minkowski spacetime, working in the Riemannian or Euclidean space, I should say, and then analytically continuing back in many cases. All of this is absent in a general curved spacetime. You can't make sense of any of this. So there's really a major question of how do you formulate quantum field theory? Or another way of saying this is you can really, it's a non-trivial question to ask whether quantum field theory is actually compatible with what one might call general covariance, the space-time notion that one has in general relativity, where you don't have any, you know, rigid Poincaré symmetry or anything of that sort. I've just written a few words on why one might be interested in the formulation of quantum field theory in curved space-time, besides the fact that there are many interesting applications like the Hawking effect and so on that I won't be talking about in this talk. Well, I think perhaps the most important reason is I think already our deepest insights into the quantum nature of gravity have come from quantum field theory in curved space-time. And if we can formulate it properly and correctly, my hope is that one will get further deep insights into quantum gravity. This despite the fact that we're treating gravity entirely classically in this formulation. Okay, well, one could start with trying to formulate the theory of a linear, that is, a free quantum field, one that is satisfying a linear wave equation in curved space-time. And the sort of first step one might do in, or one of the first equations one might try to generalize to curved space-time does generalize entirely straightforwardly. These are the fundamental commutation relations of the quantum field. So here, my field, scalar field, is denoted phi, and one of the key features of quantum field theory is you can't define the quantum field as an observable at a point. You can only define it distributionally. So here I've smeared it with a test function. And the commutation relation that you have in flat space-time between two such smeared fields is that their commutator is a multiple of the identity, that multiple being the advanced minus retarded Green's function. This corresponds exactly to the usual position momentum type commutation relations on a three slice. So it can be motivated that way, and one would similarly wish to impose this in curved space-time. Well, the generalization of this to curved space-time is as trivial and straightforward as one might like it to be, because in a globally hyperbolic curved space-time, one still has unique advanced and retarded Green's functions. But as I've already indicated, it's hard to repeat any of the other steps in the absence of any time translation symmetry in the space-time. There's no preferred vacuum state. There's no natural particle interpretation of the theory. And in fact, things are worse. I've said more or less said this already, but things are actually worse, because if you look for Hilbert space representations of these canonical commutation relations, at least in a space-time with non-compact Cauchy surface, there's no preferred Hilbert space representation either. And of course, if the space-time is not asymptotically flat in a very strong sense, there's no sensible notion, or asymptotically something or other in a very strong sense. You know, if you're starting with a Big Bang singularity or whatever, it's silly to even think about talking about S matrices. So all of this has been well recognized for several decades, and by really, I'd say, the mid-1980s or so, certainly by late 1980s, early 1990s, it was clear how to solve all of these, the problems associated with all these difficulties, which is to simply formulate the theory in the algebraic approach and make all physical predictions in terms of probabilities for measuring field observables in given states rather than scattering amplitudes or other things that one normally focuses on in quantum field theory and flat space time. So let me give you, some details, but this view graph basically has all the details, well, all but maybe one, I'll explain that in a second, on how you formulate linear quantum field theory in curved space-time. And it's really remarkably simple. So first of all, the theory is going to be about field observables like the field operator smeared with the distribution. It will include observables that are products of these things and so on. The rest of this talk after this view graph is that one wants to do a lot more. One wants nonlinear functions of this field variable too, phi squared smeared with a test function or something like that. So we can construct the desired algebra of observables in this totally straightforward and totally trivial manner. Namely, you can just write down a free algebra that you would generate from this expression and this expression putting a star on it. So write down all polynomial type, finite sums of finite products of phi smeared with things and phi star quantity smeared with things. And then you can write down the relations that you'd like to hold in this algebra. Well, this is supposed to be a distribution. It should be linear in F. This is the condition that phi be real. This is the condition, the distributional form of the condition that phi satisfies the wave equation. And then we have these fundamental commutation relations. So if we just take this free algebra and factor it by these relations, that is the algebra of observables that we want to consider. So that's all. Don't have no norms, no topologies, no C star structure, nothing. It's just this very trivial, bare, raw algebra. Okay, now an absolutely key ingredient is this algebraic notion of states. So a state on this algebra of observables is defined to be simply a linear map from the algebra of observables into the complex numbers that is positive in this sense here. So the value of an observable in the state is interpreted physically as being the expectation value of this observable in that state. Now, if you haven't seen this before, it certainly doesn't look a lot like the usual Hilbert space and vectors or density matrices in a Hilbert space. But in fact, any state or density matrix by the operation of taking expectation values will give you a state in the algebraic sense.
Do these factor ordering problems show up somewhere?
These are the observables. No, there's no.
No function.
If you're trying to make an observable that's made out of position and momenta type things, of course, then you have to, since they don't commute, you have to decide. But that's not an issue here. I mean, we just have the. So as I was saying, this might not look, if you're familiar with the usual Hilbert space things, but in fact, any Hilbert space, if you have a Hilbert space where these observables are represented as operators, then any state in the usual Hilbert space sense will immediately be seen to be a state in the algebraic sense. The other way around is true as well, because given any state in the algebraic sense, the GNS construction shows you how to construct a Hilbert space, a representation of the algebra, and a representation of the algebra such that this original state is now a state in the is a vector, in fact, in the Hilbert space. In fact, yeah, I thought somebody might ask me that. So the GNS theorem states that if you have any star algebra and any state in the sense, then there exists a Hilbert space, a representation of the algebra as operators on the Hilbert space, and a vector in this Hilbert space such that this state corresponds to taking expectation values in that state. The idea, this is proven in a really very straightforward and simple manner, which is basically you got the vector space that you want to make into a Hilbert space basically with this algebra itself. The omega practically introduces an inner product on A, except it might have some zero norm vectors that you'll then have to factor out by. But using this as an inner product with the appropriate factoring, you can complete it to get a Hilbert space, and the algebra knows how to act on itself, so you get the representation on it that you want. What I do want to emphasize here with this is that I think this puts Hilbert spaces in the proper light as a, not as something fundamental at all to the formulation of quantum mechanics, but as a sort of convenient auxiliary tool for doing certain calculations, and the most important calculation that I have in mind is computing probabilities. The states immediately give you expectation values, but you'd like probabilities for the observables, and what I claim is you can get those by going to GNS representation of the state, and then at least provided the observables are represented as self-adjoint operators, I'll return to that briefly in a remark at the end, you can now use usual Hilbert space methods to get the probabilities.
Is it right that you get a different Hilbert space if you change the state in general?
Well, you may or may not. If you choose a state that's in the same representation as the one you chose, then you won't. But if you choose a state that's not in that representation, then of course you will.
Well, so, you never said what GNS actually stands for.
Gelfand, Neymark, and Siegel. So, in fact, maybe I'll leave this one up here just so that you can learn free field theory, even if I don't do too well in the rest of the talk. Because that is free field theory. Oh, the one thing that I've left out is, I mean, it would be nice to prove that there exist states for the free field algebra that I've defined. That takes a bit of work. It's not that easy to show positivity of some linear map. The easiest way of showing that is to construct a Hilbert space, a Fock representation in the usual way. Then you can explicitly see states. Okay, but that's not. Sorry, I've done that one already. That's not the end of the talk, because one wants and needs to do quite a bit more than what I've just described. Namely, there are two very important reasons you've got to go beyond this algebra of observables that I've just defined. So first of all, even if we were only interested in free field theory and didn't care about nonlinear field theories, quantum field theories, there are lots of other observables that we'd like to know about that are not represented in A. Basically, this algebra A that I've defined here is telling you about the field itself and correlation functions of the field, but it's not telling you about any nonlinear field observables like stress energy tensor, which is the classical expression is quadratic in the field. That's not in this observable. So we'd like to enlarge the algebra of observables to encompass many other observables of interest. A second reason is that if we want to do nonlinear fields, and even if we're only going to try to talk about them perturbatively, the perturbative rules require that you be able to have representatives of the things that appear in the interaction Lagrangian, the Wick powers, which will in general be Wick powers of the field, polynomials in the field. Those, you need those just because they come into the interaction Lagrangian. And then there's a further major problem in that the perturbative expressions involve, even after you've defined these for the free field, you've got to the perturbative expressions involve time-ordered products of these Wick powers. And again, that's not something that is in this original algebra. So what's the problem with extending things? Well, it's exactly the problem that I just mentioned. Fundamentally, this quantum field is a distribution. Its value at a point doesn't make sense. So if you try to square it, that really doesn't make sense as anything, not even as a distribution in general. Well, you might think, okay, let's take phi of x, phi of y, and we can smear it with any smooth functions in x and y. So let's smear it this way and let f approach a delta function. But if you try to do that, you can easily see that your expressions you write down are just divergent and it doesn't make any sense. You've got to do some sort of regularization. Even after you've solved this problem, then you have the problem of defining time-ordered products. Well, that's easy enough if the, you know, things you're smearing into are appropriately time-separated, so you can say which is first, which is second. And in fact, really the only problem is defining this object distributionally on the total diagonal. It's perfectly well defined in a natural way off of the total diagonal, but you have to, but it is non-trivial to figure out what this is supposed to be, how you're supposed to extend it to the total diagonal. What you might think this is sort of the difficult problem, and this is something that could be solved pretty easily once you figured this out. This is, of course, what's solved in the first couple of pages of quantum field theory books with normal ordering, a prescription that doesn't work at all in curved space-time, as I'll explain. This is the difficult thing that multi-chapters of quantum field theory books talk about, and in fact, you know, don't usually in the books at least present, you know, the complete solution of, although they indicate what's going on.
Would that be arbitrary projector?
Okay. So I said a great deal of progress has been made in the last 10 years, and really, that progress is, I think, could be entirely attributed, or almost entirely attributed, to the importation of the microlocal analysis ideas of Hormander, developed 30 years ago or so, into the subject. It's actually, there's some interesting history, which I don't know all of and which I won't attempt to go into here, but Whiteman really played a rather central role in this. It was his student, Radzikowski, who really first non-trivially used these methods in quantum field theory and curved space-time. But Whiteman also had interactions with Hormander that had some influence, I think, in the development of the subject itself. You'll see in Hormander Dussermat paper the distinguished parametrices, one of which is the Feynman propagator, playing a direct role in the subject. So, of course, in this audience here, I think it divides into the people who know a lot more about microlocal analysis than I do and the people who don't know anything about microlocal analysis. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I thought I'd say at least a couple of words to give you the idea of what the key ideas that are being used here and how they have played a role, or, well, I'll explain shortly how they play, to some degree, at least how they played a role in the subject. So the basic ideas, well, first of all, we're concerned with local properties of distributions, so we might as well consider distributions of compact support and even presume that the support is arbitrarily, you know, as small as we like. In which case, we might as well pretend that this distribution is in Rn rather than in whatever curved space-time we're dealing with. And having done that, we can straightforwardly define the Fourier transform of the distribution, and that will automatically, since it's of compact support, be an analytic function and polynomially bounded in K.
Is there an integral over X that you've not written?
Well, that's what it, you know, this is the distribution applied to this test function. Now, that's not a test function, really, but since this is of compact support, this might just as well have been a test function, because you can cut it off outside the support of the distribution, so this is perfectly well defined. Now, two key ideas that I, or two key facts that are worth keeping in mind to see how this helps you and works, is that if this distribution happened to have been given by a smooth function, in fact, that can be completely characterized in the Fourier transform. This compact support distribution would, in fact, have been a smooth function if and only if its Fourier transform decays faster than in any inverse power of k, as k goes to infinity. And then I remind you of this convolution formula that expresses the square of a smooth function in terms of the convolution of its Fourier transforms. And recall, the Fourier transform for any distribution is a function, so one just has to worry about the growth of this function at large k to see whether a formula like this would make sense in the case of distributions. So the key idea in this subject is the notion of the wavefront set of a distribution, which is a refined characterization of the singularities of distributions that not only tell you what points the distribution is singular at, but tell you what direction in at least the cotangent bundle the distribution is, or the covectors at which the distribution is singular. And the idea is, if you have a distribution, you can, if you can suitably localize it by multiplying by near the point x by multiplying it by a smooth function of compact support, and you then look at its Fourier transform, if in some direction that Fourier transform decays rapidly the way a smooth function should decay, then you say that is a non-singular direction at that point. Of course, if all directions are non-singular at that point, then the distribution was in fact a smooth function in a neighborhood of that point. So if you look at the points and directions where you don't have this Fourier transform decay property, that defines the wavefront set. And as I said, that's a refined characterization of the singularities of distributions. But now, if the wavefront set characters of distributions are suitable, you can immediately see by the Fourier transform convolution formula whether you can define things like products of distributions and so on. If you're multiplying something that's distributional with something that whose decay properties leave it outside the wavefront set, that convolution type integral will converge, and so you can define the square of the idea is you can define the square, for example, of a distribution if whenever k is in the wavefront set, this object would not be in the wavefront set. Okay. So one of the key ideas that got this subject going then was this result of Radzikowski. I've mentioned his name already. So in extending the definition of, or extending the algebra of observables to things like stress energy tensor, that had been studied quite a bit over the years, and it was understood basically that you shouldn't expect to define the stress energy tensor and other Wick powers for all states, but you should only be able to define it for states whose two-point function is of the so-called Hadamard form, which I've written here. Sigma is the squared geodesic distance between the two points. And of course, there need to be suitable I epsilons in this to properly define this as a distribution. What Radzikowski proved is that this rather awkward Hadamard condition, which can only be sort of stated locally, and then you have to put on other conditions to say there are no other singularities than what's occurring here, that in fact is equivalent to a very simple wavefront set condition on this distribution on M cross M, defined over here. So using this machinery then, Brunetti, Freidenhagen, and Kohler defined an enlarged algebra of observables by doing as follows. I said there's a problem choosing vacuum states. The problem isn't that there aren't any. The problem is that there are way too many. There are zillions of them, and none of them are distinguished in a general curved space-time. But they said choose any one of them, go to the GNS representation of that state, which is the same thing as the Fock space that you'd make out of that, starting with that vacuum state. Use normal ordering now in this representation. And then they noted that, or showed that the wavefront set properties of this distribution, this operator value distribution in this case, in fact, was such that you could make sense of smearing it, not just with test functions, but with a delta function in all variables times a test function. So that basically showed that the normal ordered phi to the n and other similar nonlinear polynomial type things made sense as operator value distributions on this this Hilbert space. That the collection of all things smeared with all distributions of the general type that they considered, which was large enough not only to include the Wick powers, but to include time-ordered products, then defines an algebra of observables. Although you have these inequivalent Hilbert space representations, the enlarged algebra of observables can be shown then to be independent of what choice of state you have. So you really have a well-defined now algebra of observables. You could also define this more abstractly by the algebraic relations that, you know, the sort of Wick theorem type relations that hold between these observables. That, however, does not solve the problem, because I'd like to know what phi to the n is, not normal ordered phi to the n. And if you thought normal ordered phi to the n was the right answer for what phi to the n is, then you'd have to tell me which state you want to choose to define the normal ordering. So it's not clear what we have the appropriate algebra of observables, but there's a major problem still left to figure out what observables represent, what elements of those algebras are supposed to represent things like phi squared or various time-ordered products. So the key further idea to aid in that process is the idea that the fields we're defining should be locally and covariantly defined. This is in plays the role, in fact, in curved space-time quantum field theory of Poincaré invariance in flat space-time, as I'll, in fact, add a remark in just a minute to explain further. So this idea, so what I've written here is supposed to be expressing the idea that the definition of the field should depend only on the space-time. If I want to define the field near point X, it should depend only on what the space-time geometry near point X is doing, and of course it should depend covariantly on the space-time geometry there. And the idea is the following. So first of all, of course, for every space-time, every different space-time, we get a completely different algebra of observables. So we can't compare a field operator in one algebra to a field operator in another algebra in general. But there's one circumstance where we can, which is if we have a space-time or a portion of a space-time that's isometrically embedded into a portion of another space-time. If we have this situation, then the algebra of observables that's defined over here is one has a natural isomorphism of that into the subalgebra of observables, the subalgebra of the W over here, corresponding to smearing in with test functions in this region. So now the whole idea is that we'll say that a quantum, well, first of all, We have to be defining quantum field theory in all globally hyperbolic space-times. If we just try to define it in one space-time, we have way too much ambiguity and freedom. We have to be, our task is, has to be thought of as defining quantum field theory in all space-times. And the idea is having defined it in all space-times and having, well, a quantum field, of course, is an assignment of an element in this algebra of observables to each space-time. And the idea is that this quantum field will be said to be locally and covariantly defined if, whenever you have this situation, and you take the field phi defined over here, bring it over to here, it is just what you call the field phi over here, smeared with the appropriate, you know, image of the test function that you were smearing it with over there. This takes a little time, I think, to get used to this notion, but let me just, and I won't take more time here, but let me just comment that in the case where the space-time is flat, we can isometrically embed flat space-time into itself by a Poincaré symmetry. And this condition here is then just precisely the condition that the definition of the fields are Poincaré invariant. So it really does have the same strength and power as Poincaré invariants, but it's entirely, you know, a generally covariant curved space-time notion. So with all that in place, one can write down then a wish list of what the definition of, let's say, phi to the n ought to be if you're trying to define Wick powers, one of the key things we need to define as I've written over here. So one key condition is that this should be local and covariant. There's a natural commutation relation that this should have with the free field. This is just the reality condition. In a Hadamard state, this object ought to be smooth. And then there are two other conditions that are a little bit more subtle, but we would like the definition of the field to vary analytically if we have, with the space-time metric, if we have some one-parameter family of analytic space-times that is analytic in the parameter. And we'd like this also, this is an independent condition, to vary smoothly with the parameter if we have a one-parameter family of smooth space-time metrics that vary smoothly there. Since this is a distribution, it's a little tricky to define what you mean. That really is most appropriately defined as a wavefront set condition on this distribution viewed as a distribution on parameter space cross the manifold. And then one might wish to impose the sort of classical scaling behavior of the quantum on the quantum field. If you scale the space-time metric, you might want your definition of phi to the n to scale in the natural way associated with the sort of classical dimension of that. One of the subtleties of quantum field theory is that this scaling just doesn't hold. If you required exact scaling, you could prove there is no quantum field theory. What you can impose, though, is that the scaling be homogeneous up to polynomials in the logarithm of this parameter. Well, those are the properties of Wick powers. There's a much more complicated list and slightly longer list of axioms that one could write down for the time-ordered products, but I'm not going to attempt to do that here. Having written down what you'd like the quantities to be. In fact, for the Wick powers, it's not difficult to prove uniqueness up to specified local curvature type ambiguities. The commutation relation by itself that I wrote down on the previous view graph determines what, let's say, phi squared is up to a multiple of the identity. The local covariance condition tells you that this multiple of the identity has to be made out of the space-time geometry. The continuity or the smoothness and analyticity conditions basically tell you this has to be made out of the curvature, and the scaling condition tells you it has to be made out of curvature terms of the right dimension, leading to just a one parameter ambiguity then in the definition of phi squared, and by induction you can then get the ambiguities for everything else. Well, I won't talk about this, but a similar but much more complicated argument for the time-ordered products then shows uniqueness of those. I haven't talked about existence yet, but uniqueness of those up to, again, certain specified ambiguities. And these ambiguities, if you're trying to keep count of them, correspond to, well, the usual way people characterize these ambiguities in terms of counterterms in the Lagrangian. You have exactly the same, you know, ambiguity in the renormalization prescription in curved space-time, except those Lagrangian counterterms can now include couplings to curvature, as long as they're covariantly defined couplings to curvature. Okay, well, that's uniqueness, which is nice, but isn't too helpful for anything if we don't have existence. But in fact, existence can be proven as well. In the case of Wick powers, that's pretty straightforward. Normal ordering gets rid of the singularities in suitably to enable you to smear with delta functions and define Wick powers. But normal ordering with respect to a state doesn't give you a local and covariant expression. But what you can do, instead of subtracting off some sort of vacuum expectation value, is you can subtract off some locally constructed Hadamard parametrics, which is locally and covariantly constructed out of the space-time geometry in the neighborhood of the point x at which you're trying to define, let's say, phi squared. And this works fine to then give you a prescription for defining, well, this phi squared, and with a suitable combinatorical generalization of this, you can define all Wick powers. One of the things I really want to emphasize is that you do not, I mean, normal ordering is an accident of that it's the correct prescription in flat space time, is a total accident of the fact that the vacuum expectation value of fields happens to equal this locally and covariantly constructed Hadamard parametrics in flat space-time. Flat space-time is trivial enough that that can happen. The regularization that you need to do for Wick powers can never otherwise, or cannot otherwise, be thought of as subtracting off vacuum values of things, or for that matter, subtracting off quantities in any state. Okay, well, I won't even say anything about this except to indicate on this view graph that a much more complicated argument can be used to, in fact, prove existence of time-ordered products satisfying these conditions. And the basic idea is that since you're really the whole problem is at the total diagonal, when all these points coincide, you can basically do a scaling expansion around this coincidence limit and show that you just get a finite number of terms that you really have to worry about, plus a piece that that already continuously extends or nicely extends to the total diagonal. And then each of these pieces you can convert to basically a flat space time problem in the tangent space. These will be flat space-time distributions in the tangent space that'll be Lorentz invariant times curvature terms, and then you can use flat space-time techniques to do the renormalization of those quantities. So that, what I've just described, in fact, shows that we've got this enlarged algebra, and now up to ambiguities that I've just specified, which one can't do much about, one has defined the observables that we want to define, namely these Wick powers and time-ordered products, as elements of this algebra. So One thing, though, you might ask is, now what do we do? Because I don't want to use this particularly to calculate S matrices or things like that. Well, maybe in some circumstances I might want to calculate S matrices, but in a general curved space time, that's not going to be a useful concept. What I just wanted to point out is that perturbation theory allows one to, if you know what all Wick powers and time-ordered products are, allows one to write down a formula for the interacting quantum field. Well, here is just the interacting phi that I've written down in, well, I've chosen to write down lambda phi to the fourth theory or whatever in this. This is, of course, this simple looking expression the way I've written here is some horribly complicated sums of, you know, time-ordered product type expressions. One can write down similar formulas for all, you know, Wick powers and so on of the interacting field in this manner. These formulas are at least 50 years old. Bogoliubov certainly wrote them down. I think I just want to mention that at least these perturbative formulas are completely well defined. You need, in order for these expressions to make sense, effectively the interaction Lagrangian to be turned on and turned off by multiplication by a smooth test function. But there's no issue of any limits existing as you let lambda go to a constant value, because you can take the limit in a suitable way where you maybe make lambda constant in this interior region here and make it zero outside, and then consider some nested sequence of test functions where you make lambda go to lambda naught everywhere. But instead of keeping the field fixed, say, in the past, as you take this limit, you can do it in a way to keep the field fixed in the interior, in which case there's just no issue of this formula making sense in the limit as the constant value of the coupling constant goes out to infinity. Well, that's more of a minor side point in this. What I'm claiming is, or what I've claimed to have shown to you now, is that perturbatively, as a formal power series, I want to get back to that issue also in final remarks, what I've shown you allows you to define the interacting fields and thereby the interacting field algebra for arbitrary interactions in an arbitrary globally hyperbolic curved space-time. So what are the main conclusions, just to reemphasize that? So at least for the case that I've been explicitly discussing, that of a scalar field, I claim that free quantum field theory in curved space-time, first of all, for the free Klein-Gordon scalar field, that has been formulated in a mathematically precise way in which all Wick polynomials of the free field are well defined up to expected renormalization ambiguities, and all time-ordered products of the free quantum field theory in curved space-time have also been well defined up to expected renormalization ambiguities. And given this, then if you are attempting to perturbatively define the interacting quantum field theory in curved space-time, each term in the perturbation series to all orders is rigorously well defined for arbitrary interactions. Right. The main point I've been making here is that this has been done without Poincaré or any other symmetry being assumed. No preferred vacuum state or any other preferred state has played any role. And of course, although the microlocal analysis can be viewed as a kind of local version of Fourier transform methods, no globally defined type Fourier transforms have ever been taken, and no Euclideanization of anything has ever been done, because again, that is not a tool that's available. The theory that's been formulated has been is entirely local and covariant in nature. If you want to know what's going on in a little region, you only have to know about that little region, you know, the formulation of the theory, not some asymptotic boundary conditions or anything of that sort. And you may notice that it's been totally devoid of all kinds of, well, of various completely extraneous notions, most notably particles. I haven't said a word about them because there isn't any fundamental concept of particles, certainly in quantum field theory and curved space-time, just as there's no preferred vacuum state. There are a couple of further developments that I think are worthy of mention, and then I'll mention a few open issues. So first of all, renormalization group flow plays a big role in quantum field theory and flat space-time. That can be perfectly well defined in curved space-time, but that's most naturally thought of as the behavior of the quantum field theory under scaling of the metric. If you scale the metric to go to a new space-time, you can actually do one of two things. You can take the answers you had, the formulas for the field and so on, in the original space-time and just scale those by the classical scaling laws, or you can apply your renormalization prescription to the this new curved space-time. And because of the non-trivial scaling in quantum field theory that I've already alluded to, you'll get different answers that will correspond to sort of the flow of the effective coupling constants that you've defined with your renormalization group with your renormalization prescription. The other thing, which is found quite surprising and remarkable, is that there are some additional conditions beyond what I wrote down that mainly apply when you have derivatives of expressions, how you define those, that are quite natural, that basically say that the interacting quantum field theory that you would, if you had a free quantum field theory, but you treated part of the interaction as though, you know, a term in the Lagrangian, as though it were an interaction and calculated things perturbatively, then you should get the same answer as if you did the original calculation, did the calculation purely in the free theory. In other words, well, we call this principle of perturbative agreement. And rather remarkably, when you impose those conditions, and it's actually not even that trivial to show that you can impose the conditions, but we showed that you can, that we being Stefan Hollands and I, then remarkably, it comes out for free that the, again, order by order in perturbation theory, the interacting quantum field satisfies the interacting equations of motion, and the stress energy tensor of the interacting quantum field theory is conserved. This is for arbitrary interactions now, including non-renormalizable interactions. It's just automatically true that these two facts hold. Okay, so finally, I just want to make a few comments on open issues. So I've talked exclusively, and certainly all the work that I've been involved with has exclusively focused on the scalar field. I would expect that extension to of everything said here to fermion field should be completely straightforward, just a few changes of signs. I believe that extensions to gauge field should be possible. There is an algebraic version of BRST that seems appropriate to an appropriate tool to be able to use to take the same ideas used for the scalar field and apply them to gauge fields. One could also try to apply it to gravity itself, you know, perhaps breaking up the metric into a classical background piece plus the thing that you view as a quantum field. I certainly do not expect that this will work at all, because there just aren't any gauge invariant observables in gravity that are local in the sense that's being used here. There are in gauge theories, but there aren't in gravity. One point that I want to mention and bring out here, although it's an embarrassment, I think, is that it's really key to the whole field theory point of view that these observables be self-adjoint operators. But amazingly, at least to me, it's not known. I mean, even in free quantum field theory in Minkowski space-time, whether sufficiently high Wick powers, and sufficiently high, I think, includes even just the stress energy tensor, are essentially self-adjoint on the free field Fock space in Minkowski space-time on the domain that you naturally get this operator defined on from the GNS type and Brunetti, Freidenhagen, and Kohler type construction. So it'll, as far as I'm concerned, be a disaster if this isn't essentially self-adjoint, because now one will not have well-defined probability rules. But this is something that's not known, and I think it's a question that's been completely ignored in, you know, the subject of quantum field theory because of all the focus on particles and S matrices and so on, where this isn't necessary to know. And then finally, I think the much grander scheme is what is, I've talked about perturbative interacting fields in this whole talk, but what about, you know, that is nice, but what one would really like to do surely is non-perturbative interacting quantum field theory, and it's really far from clear what that is supposed to be. Of course, quite a bit of thought was given to that in flat space time, and there's a well-developed subject of axiomatic quantum field theory and so on. But all that, again, depends heavily on Poincaré invariant vacuum states and so on. So as best as I can guess, what interacting the, of course, properties that this interacting quantum field theory have, like local and be locally and covariantly defined, satisfy certain microlocal spectral conditions instead of spectral conditions. I mean, all of that can be generalized from discussions in flat space-time easily enough. But then, you know, what is not easily generalized is the sort of Poincaré invariant vacuum state and other ingredients. What I strongly suspect the key ingredients then of that would be needed to define a non-perturbative, to define an interacting quantum field theory non-perturbatively, would be first of all the field equation, something you don't usually see written down in quantum field theory books, although sort of classically you often see the field equation written down as something important. I think that is probably a key ingredient. Commutativity for bosonic fields at space-like separations is probably a key ingredient. But the only further thing I can think of which would be sufficient to distinguish then, besides the field equation, one interacting quantum field from another, the thing that really contains the detailed information, I believe is likely to be the notion of an operator product expansion of the quantum fields at asymptotically short distances. But precisely what form this should take and properties this should have, you know, I think are still unclear. What my further thoughts, though, are is that what perturbation theory, if something along this lines is correct, then what perturbation theory really should be used for would be to calculate these, the operator product expansion coefficients appearing in here. What perturbation theory is normally used for is, first of all, to try to calculate properties of states, ground states, particles, things like that. Those clearly don't vary analytically with the coupling parameter of the theory by arguments that are at least 50 years old. And so you have no chance of no reason to even hope that perturbation theory should converge. Even this nice Bogoliubov formula that I wrote down, I won't bother flashing it up again, that's trying to express the interacting quantum field as an element of the free field algebra. Well, I don't think the interacting quantum field lives in the free field algebra. I really wouldn't expect that formula to converge. But the operator product coefficient should exist, and when I'm in a very optimistic mood, my thoughts are that perhaps if perturbation theory were to be used in this manner, you might get convergent results from it and be able to make complete sense then out of perturbation theory. But I've gone on already too long, so I better stop here. Thanks.
Say that the Fourier transform is used only locally here, you don't need here,
yeah.
You have no notion.
Right. Right. It's only used in exactly the, you know, micro-local sense.
Evan, you've emphasized here that you have, in some sense, no need for particles. But what
well,
about...
Whether I have need or not, I mean, there isn't any notion of particles at a fundamental level. I mean, of course, there's approximate notions of particles, and we use those all the time. But fundamentally...
So my question was really, I mean, in cosmology, people want to talk about particle creation, for instance. So my question was, how does that kind of relate to the formalism that you've been discussing here?
Well... You know, we in this room, when talking to undergraduates, for example, like to talk about the gravitational force between two masses. How do we make sense of that? Well, I mean, obviously, in appropriate limits, you have, you know, you can make sense of Newtonian concepts in general relativity, and similarly, in appropriate limits, where basically the, you know, if the time variation of the space. If roughly speaking, the time, you know, variation of the space-time, where the space-time is time-varying on a time scale long compared to the frequency of the particles you're trying to define, then you have no great trouble defining an approximate notion of particles. So in the cosmological context today, as long as we're talking about particles whose, you know, Compton wavelength is not larger, well, not Compton wavelength, but wavelength is not larger than the Hubble radius, or, you know, time variation, you know, is not slower than the Hubble time, you know, we're basically in good shape. And similarly in the early universe, although the curvature scales are a lot, you know, smaller, there's certainly regimes where we could talk about particle creation.
Can you comment on the Hawking and Unruh effects for an interacting field?
Well, I certainly haven't done any calculation, so probably no. I mean, they'd be present. I can tell you what I think would happen, but it wouldn't be any different from what I would have said 25 years ago without knowing any of this stuff.
Perhaps a follow-up question. Where do you expect this interacting theory to bring something new to the picture that we had before the interacting theory was developed? I mean, because we had this free field theory on curved space-time, and where do you expect the interacting field theory to play a major role?
In terms of, you know, physical application, I don't know. I mean, you know, one wouldn't expect the curved space aspect of the interacting quantum field theory, certainly you wouldn't expect that to play any role in laboratory experiments, but I don't think that one would expect that the effects to be, you know, unless there's some subtlety that's not been seen, to be large enough to, say, affect cosmological constant problem or something of that sort. I mean, if you do back-of-the-envelope calculations of what you'd expect the effects to be, they'd be way too small compared with cosmological constant effects. You know, they'd be curvature squared kind of effects and so on. But I don't know. I mean,
because you were discussing this renormalization ambiguities, and because of the coupling to the curvature, actually, can you say that the mass of the electron, for instance, can depend on the curvature of the universe where it's found?
Yeah, there's probably a, you know, additional ambiguity of adding, you know, well, you have to decide how you're going to define, I mean, you would normally define the mass of an electron in terms of properties it would have in some situation like flat space-time, in which case, of course, it doesn't depend on the curvature by definition. A lot of this has to do with how you're going to define the mass of an electron. That also goes back to how you're going to define an electron in curved space-time, which is not obvious, since there isn't any notion of fundamental notion of particles, right? So,
what does the progress since 1980 that you talked about in quantum field theory, quantum space-time, tell us about quantum gravity?
I don't think anything. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the Hawking effect and so on has told us a lot about quantum. Probably it's about the only thing we know about quantum gravity. The interacting quantum field theory developments that I've described, I think, don't particularly tell us anything, although, you know, directly certainly about quantum gravity. But I suppose my strong feeling is it's pointing us in the direction of forgetting about vacuum states, forgetting about, you know, in other words, if one is basing some theory of quantum gravity on some notion of a vacuum state, I would tend to be much more skeptical of that, having been convinced now that I see quantum field theory can work fine without these extraneous notions. I'd be very surprised if they come back in when we do quantum gravity. I mean, so, you know, one might arguably say one has learned these sort of things, or at least I've concluded these sort of things, but I, you know, I don't think any physical insights into quantum gravity have emerged yet.
We have two more questions. Robert.
This is a fairly elementary question, I think. What's the mass of an electron? Not an electron, it's much simpler, a photon in any sort of quantized gravity. I mean, does it make any sense at all to ask this? Do you expect something like the positive mass theorem still to hold? This could almost be viewed as a classical question. Can you?
Well,
does the mass of a photon make any sense?
Right. So, I mean, well, let's see. The energy of a photon, again, in flat, would certainly make sense, and so on. I mean, the mass, I mean, is just really, you know, for the free electromagnetic field, you would just define the, you know, I mean, the mass would be zero, and, you know, it would be just defined in terms of, you know, Poincaré group, or could be defined in terms of just Poincaré group properties of the representation given by the electromagnetic field.
Gary, does this story extend to anti-de Sitter space-time?
So anti-de Sitter is not globally hyperbolic. So, you know, in that sense, I suppose no. But if you put appropriate boundary conditions at, you know, time like infinity, then everything should extend. And of course, you know, take any globally hyperbolic portion of anti-de Sitter space-time, and then it applies, you know, without any qualifications. But so I think I would say yes, it applies to anti-de Sitter space-time. But of course, you have to, as long as the classical dynamics is well defined, then these ideas should apply. So it's a question of whether you view the classical dynamics well defined on anti-de Sitter.
Okay, so let's thank Bob again.